Hello, this is Louisa Beale with Radio Tacoma, and I'm here with Stephanie Masterman, who has been to Standing Rock, and I will let her introduce herself and tell you a little bit about what she saw there. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, my name is Stephanie Masterman. I am a 21-year-old Tlingit from Southeast Alaska, and I live here in Seattle.
When did you go to Standing Rock?
The first time I went out to Standing Rock was in the summertime, August 31st through September 12th. I was out there for about 2.5 weeks. And then more recently, the Monday following the Sunday, where many people have heard about the most recent major incident between the police and the water protectors. The day where Sophia lost her arm, the day where the police were blasting water protectors with water hoses in 16 degree weather in the middle of the night. Multiple people were shot close range by rubber bullets and were sent to the hospital. My flight landed the following day. That was all of the news I was getting, so it wasn't an easy trip. I got there that Monday, and I left the following Friday evening. So I got back last Saturday.
So what did you do there?
The first time I was there, I didn't really have any idea what I was going to be doing there. I've been to many protests and rallies and marches here in Seattle, so I thought that maybe I would end up doing something like that. But when I arrived, I realized it was going to be much different. I actually spent a lot of time in camp, and a group of women that I caravaned with from Seattle, we actually started up a women's camp because at the time there wasn't any place for women to go to have their own solitude. So we created the women's camp, and since then the camp has been taken care of by other women. The camp is still there. It's called the Wianan Camp, which is Wianan is how you say women in Lakota,
mm-hmm.
if I pronounce it correctly. But so that camp has been upheld, and so I spent a lot of time just taking care of the camp, and of course lots of prayer and lots of ceremony. Now the second time that I went there, things are a little bit different. So we were doing prayer marches and prayer walks the previous visit. The following visit, because of all of the escalated violence from the police, it seems like a lot of people in the camp wanted to continue direct action. And then I think the tribal council and the elders in the camp did not want so much direct action to be taking place because people were getting hurt. You could feel that imbalance of energy when I got there. So actually, the group that I traveled with, we ended up just staying in camp the whole time. However, the group that I was with, that I stayed with, they had arrived. They're also from Seattle. They're from Muckleshoot. They had arrived that Saturday. So they were actually there in camp when all of those events happened on Sunday, and they picked me up the next day.
Wow. So what sort of things were you seeing or feeling? I mean, what was the tenor of the camp?
Mm-hmm. The first time I went, it was incredible. And it still is when you go, you get your first glimpse of the camp. You get all excited and you know that you're in the right place. I did feel personally for me that I became much stronger with my higher power when I arrived the first time. Mm-hmm. Because there was so much good, like positive energy in the air. You could just feel it. People really do everything they can to take care of each other. There isn't any room for a personal agenda there. It's really everything you do there is for the greater good of everybody around you. Any way you could be of service, then you do that. It was really, really happy. It was fun too. And there were so many different tribes from all over the country. My canoe family came down from Alaska. Several canoe families came over from the coast here in Washington. And so we did a canoe journey while I was there. And so it was very, very powerful. A lot of like high energy, positive energy. Really amazing things happened. So the second time, the more recent time that I went, there was still, you know, that good feeling of being there, but it did feel a little bit different. For example, I would say that the first time I went there, there was majority natives and indigenous people and people of color. The second time that I went there, and I wish I could phrase it better, it felt like it was majority white folks, non-natives. And that's okay, because we do call on allies for support. But what sort of happened the last couple of days is we realized it seemed like it was like turning into like a festival, like just, I'm sure it sounds weird to whoever would be listening, but there were just a lot of hippies who are there, who weren't necessarily there to do the work that was needed, mm-hmm. but just to be there, to just say they went to.
Because it seems by that time it was really getting into the news.
Yeah.
And it was almost like the place to be.
Yeah, basically. And one of the days there was really a lot of tension was on Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving morning, a group of all indigenous women, we came together and we were made it so that we were the first ones out on the front line that morning. And we did a prayer and held our own ceremony because Thanksgiving was a big day. And we wanted to make sure that everybody, all the water protectors would be protected. So that happened that day. A family from New Zealand, a Maori family, we spent a lot of time with them, and their women led the haka on the front line that day. So we were feeling pretty good. Later on Thanksgiving Day, there was a drill. So throughout the day, people were going down to the front lines. People wanted to take direct action, and it was stressful because up until that point, the police were doing anything in their power to escalate. What, even if that meant shooting people, hurting people, sending people to the emergency, they were doing all of that. Then on Thanksgiving Day, people went down to do actions, and all of a sudden, the news was watching, the world was watching, and now all of a sudden on Thanksgiving Day, the police wanted to be peaceful. So that day was kind of frustrating. There was a drill, which at the time nobody knew it was a drill. Randomly, we're in camp and a bunch of people are flying through camp on megaphones yelling, shots fired, everybody get to safety, women and children go to the dome, women and children go to the dome. And so we were all like, what on earth is this? And everybody around started freaking out. And so the thing to keep in mind here is when I said that there was feeling like there was majority non-natives, majority white folks there, mm-hmm. that's who you had running around the camp saying, shots fired, everybody get to safety, shots fired, women and children. So personally, as an indigenous woman, I've always looked to my people for guidance and for support. So to have white men and women yelling in my face that I need to get to safety when we have no idea what's going on. People were coming up and yelling at us like, what are you doing? You need to go. It was like, why, what, for what reason do we have to listen to you? We don't even know what's going on. So anyways, everybody all freaked out. And we went back to camp to make sure that everybody in our camp was good. We went back to camp to figure out what was actually going on, and nobody knew. So we stayed put and we watched so many people basically flee the camp. And then when the guys in our camp said, hey, you know, you should go, even though we didn't want to go because we were prepared to hold the ground for mm-hmm. whatever it was, we were prepared to stay. The guys in our group said go. So we went, all the women and children in our group, we went to this area they had over the bridge before you get into camp. There's a little pull off, and they had like cars full of women and children pull over there. And that's when we found out that it was a drill.
Oh,
and
my.
So basically they had everybody all freaked out, and they before telling us that it was a drill, Standing Rock Sioux Tribe was hosting a community Thanksgiving dinner at their community center. I believe it was in Fort Yates. So they had buses prepared to take loads of people there. Mm-hmm. When it seemed like most of the women and children were in that safe place, an elder got on the microphone and she was saying, "If that scared you, then you need to pack up your things and leave, because we aren't here to be running away as soon as something scary happens," because so many people were freaking out. And for me, it's really hard to say these things, because I'm not only Tlingit, I am part English, Irish, and German, so I don't like saying the terms white folks. But to be honest, from what I saw, majority of the white folks there were scurrying around, freaking out, panicking, and majority of the indigenous and people of color there were remaining calm and figuring out, okay, what do we do? Because we are raised, it is part of our traditions that we know to hold our ground and to prepare for what's going to come. And so it was really, really stressful to have all of that happening. So anyways, this elder, she says, "If that scared you, you need to pack up your things and go home, mm-hmm. because this isn't the place for you to be." And so they have these busloads of people going into the community center, and it seemed almost as if they did that to weed out the people who are not there for the right reasons.
Yeah.
And that way the only people would be left in camp would be the people who were there to hold the ground, you know, to do all the things that needed to be done around the camp. And so meanwhile, people were getting prepared for a real action. It seemed kind of like ironic or just strange that drill would happen while at the same time people are getting ready for an actual action to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And what was really tough was after everybody found out it was a drill, all these cars that had left when they thought it was a real deal, all these busloads of people that had gone when they thought it was a real deal, it's like as soon as word got out that it was a drill, mm-hmm. they all came back, and it seemed like all these cars full of people, what they did was they went straight to the front lines to go take pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember standing against the car with the women that I went with, and there was a group of like four white women in front of me, and this elder was saying, "If you're not prepared to go to the front lines, then you need to go home." And basically we noticed that a lot of the times during the actions, the police tend to go after women in general, people who seem like they're leaders, but it seems like they were going after like blonde women for some reason. So they kind of put that as a warning. As this woman was speaking to everybody, telling everybody that, I watched these four white women in front of me almost like giggling, like, "Oh my gosh, really?" Like, you know, like not taking it serious at all. And
right.
They're like, "Oh my gosh." So I don't even know how to explain. To me, that really not only made me angry, but it made mm-hmm. me sad, because people weren't really realizing how big of a deal, how serious this thing actually is. It's not just a pipeline. It's everything revolving around oppression against indigenous people and people of color that we have been facing for the last 500 plus years.
Yes.
So, and it all happens in that instant of just seeing somebody act a certain way in a space that should be and was an indigenous space. So in a really, really long way to answer your question, this trip, it was really hard to be there, because it felt like yet another indigenous space or something that belonged to us, a movement that our people were taking control over, another thing that was ours, that was taken over by the white man. And yeah. it sucks to really have to say it that way. But that's what it was.
Yeah.
And I experienced several different occasions. I went to a direct action training where none of the women, especially Indigenous women in that direct action training, which was a practice, felt safe just because of having all these people, especially white men, trying to jump into those leadership roles and control everything and be the voices that wash out everybody else. And so it was really, really tough. I felt like I was in a strange workplace that wasn't anything like this world that I'm used to. Like, even we had like folks there who would come take pictures of us as they walk by our camp to be like, oh my gosh, you know, there's a Native person. And it's like, really?
Yeah.
You know, and it was frustrating also because I'm mixed race, but I did find myself almost judging every white person I saw,
mm-hmm.
because you would see them stare you down too, and it was so uncomfortable, and it just hurt really bad that was what was going on in
mm-hmm.
the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I started to realize that's probably why a lot of the escalation things have been, like, so many people have been getting hurt, because they're so unorganized, because there's this major chaos going on in the camp with that issue of Native voices and Native leadership being washed out.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really tough, and I think that was like the main thing that I had to experience for the short week that
yeah.
I was there.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you've raised that issue, because
mm-hmm.
I think it's prime, and I think that it's something that not many people think about.
Mm-hmm.
And the mainstream media, if you want to call it that, it's like they were saying, oh, okay, so it's this pipeline, it's all about the oil and the water and whatnot. But it goes much deeper than that. And as you put your finger right on it, it's about Indigenous lands, Indigenous heritage, Indigenous culture. It's almost like a knee-jerk reaction
mm-hmm.
for white people to say, oh, okay, I know better how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And it cannot be that way. And so I'm really, really glad that you're shining a light on that issue.
Yeah, so when we talk about culture, like, unfortunately, that's the way it is. Like, I was raised that we always do everything you can to help others, you know, listen to your elders, do everything in a good way, ask for help, you know, stuff like that. And when you talk about white privilege, so many people in this, like, American culture, American society, are so sick of hearing white privilege, but it's like, it is so thriving,
mm-hmm.
white privilege, that even there in that camp, people who want to consider themselves allies, they're just doing things in a way, well, using their privilege to jump in and, like you said,
mm-hmm.
say, hey, I know a better way to do this. Well, no,
mm-hmm.
we don't need that better way. This way is just fine. This is the way we've always done it.
Mm-hmm.
No, you don't need to dig trenches to lay down your solar power wires on Sitting Bull's land when our kitchen was
mm-hmm.
doing just fine without the solar panels. We were feeding the whole entire camp beforehand
mm-hmm.
without all
mm-hmm.
those wires. And that's just another instance.
Yeah, but again, it's a whole different way of seeing things. It's a whole different way of thinking. You know, as, okay, technology is going to make this better, as opposed to, hey, this is how we do things.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think it just feeds right into how the pipeline got there in the first place.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was really tough. When the first thing I noticed when I actually got to camp was, really, I was like, whoa, like, every single person that walked past me was like another white person. The first time I was there, seemed like every person that walked past me was another Native, and when you made eye contact
mm-hmm.
with them, it was, hi, how are you? Good, you know, have
mm-hmm.
a good day. And you would just introduce yourself to every single person you saw, and where are you from? Like, you know, just for a lot of Natives, you know, when you introduce yourself, you introduce your entire family. We're always representing our entire family. And so that's what was going on, those kind of interactions, and it was beautiful. And when I first got there this recent time, it wasn't like that at all. And I noticed there's these domes and there's these big structures. It looks like people were building cabins.
You mean like permanent cabins?
Yeah, like plywood and insulation, windows, glass windows even. And it's like, are you serious? What's going on here? Because the people of that land know you can't stay there permanently. The land that Oshati Shakuin camp is on is a flood zone. And it's not safe to stay in the winter. And all the natives there know that. That's why they're all in tents and teepees and campers. They're building lodges, but they're building lodges that are movable. They're not building miniature cabins and making ways for electricity and light to go in them and building houses. And that's like, you know, just another example of that. Oh, I know a better way to do this. But the whole purpose of the camp in to be there is to be a prayer camp that heals. To leave that camp the way it was, better than the way it was when you got there. And so it was really frustrating to have a white man yelling at me for stepping over his wires as he lays his wires for his solar panel into a dugout trench that he built to protect the wires from being stepped on Sitting Bull's land. And that's just crazy, because how can we fight against a pipeline that they're digging into all these sacred lands, yet we have people digging into that very sacred land, the only land that the police and the DAPL construction haven't touched or destroyed. We're doing it right there in the camp, and it was just devastating. And so it was tough.
Oh yeah.
And I think a lot of that happened because it was so cold. And of course, it's even colder now. They're experiencing blizzards now. But a lot of the elders were not there because of the cold, because of the weather. A lot of elders had to be home. So as a Native person, we always look to our elders for guidance, for instruction, for direction. And it seems like not that the presence of elders weren't there, just it wasn't as strong as it was previously. And so I don't feel right necessarily jumping in and calling out and regulating all these people when I was just a little minority. And I live every single day of my life as this little minority, this small number, this percentage of Native people who are left here. And that's how it felt in that camp. I didn't feel like I had the power to regulate on all these people, these allies or non-Natives who were there. And so I think that's why it got to that point. A lot of the Natives may or may not have felt comfortable using their voice in that situation, because we understand that that's Sitting Bull's land. We understand the protocol and how to take care of it, but it's really hard to confront people in a place where they should just know already. If I ever enter somebody else's territory, the first thing I know is to do things in their way, to ask permission. And it's not like, no offense to anybody who's listening, but that's not the way it is in white cultures. And when I say white, I don't mean any specific culture or heritage. I mean white, like American culture, where there is no heritage, there is no tradition. It's really what it is, that colonization, that way of taking control and privilege over everything.
It's that whole mindset.
Yeah, it's that mindset. That's the culture I'm talking about. And so,
because really, you know, I've thought about this before, as, you know, a white woman. You know, I'm not white. I'm really pink, if you want to really give it a color. But I like the term, you know, the whole white mentality, because in a way it's blinding. It's like the snow blindness.
Yep.
And to me, that's what white culture is.
And I've had even coworkers ask me, what is this, like, the hate against the white man? And it's like, I have the hardest time explaining it, but the best way I can is to look at myself and say, you know, some people will call me white. I've grown up identifying only as Tlingit, as mm-hmm. Alaska Native, and when I fill out forms and all that, I always mm-hmm. write Alaska Native, but I don't ever disregard that side of me, because I love that side of me. Mm-hmm. I love, you know, my father and my father's family, and never for one second would I ever disown that part of who mm-hmm. I am. But that part of my family doesn't live with that nasty white culture. Mm-hmm. That side of my family does not.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just weird. So I always want to make sure that I'm not offending anybody, but I don't know. That's just like that everyday struggle that a lot of people face anyways, but to have it to be so powerful in a place that is supposed to be an indigenous place for ceremony is really just mind-blowing.
Right. Because that's one of the larger issues here, is the whole thing of indigenous rights, indigenous power, indigenous mm-hmm. culture, you know, being respected. And from what I'm hearing from you, you know, on this little microcosm, it was the whole colonization versus tribes all over again.
Yeah, one of the women in my group, her name is Rachel Heaton. She's really, really strong, inspirational woman, and she was saying while we were there, oh my God, it's like we just witnessed the last 500 years of colonization in 1 week. And people don't understand how intense that really is, and it is traumatizing to have to experience a life full of oppression, but the whole history of it all, it was like reoccurring in those 5 days that I was there, and it's really hard to explain that to people. And
well, I think you're doing
so,
a very good job.
It's
overwhelming. I hope you don't feel that you're holding back, because, you know, you're not going to offend anybody. I mean, and if you do, well, then that's lessons for them. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so where do you see things going from here? I know the pipeline's been stopped for now.
That's what they say. So the Army Corps of Engineers and Obama administration have denied the easement for Dakota Access Pipeline energy transfers to continue construction across the Missouri River of Lake Oahe, but they're not going to stop. It's a $3.8 billion pipeline, and they're facing a $50,000 fine every day that it will take them to, that they continue working, and it's not like it's going to take them weeks and months to drill under the river. They'll have it done. They've been moving as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. We've done everything in our power to stop them, and they have done everything in their power to stop us, even when it's illegal, even if it means injuring people, even if it means permanently injuring people for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Like they will permanently sicken people for the rest of their lives when that oil pipeline spills.
Right.
They'll do whatever it takes, even when it's illegal, and that's just the way it sucks, but sorry, that's how America is. Mm-hmm. If you have enough money, you can do whatever you want.
So they could continue just what they're doing and then just pay the fine.
They are, yep, that's exactly what they're doing. They are working as we speak. They're not necessarily drilling, but they are working. They haven't stopped. With the issue of the Army Corps denying the easement, basically what, from my understanding, and it's all different when you're not there on the ground, in the front lines, in the camp, but from my understanding is Morton County Sheriff's Department, Moron County Sheriff's Department may have to retreat and pull out their officers on the ground, which would be a good thing, which would mean that maybe our people would have, our water protectors would be able to go take direct actions and what they feel is necessary. Dakota Access Pipeline, the first week that I was in Standing Rock, the first trip I took, Dakota Access Pipeline had private security who were unleashing attack dogs on people, women and children, were sent to the hospital. A pregnant woman was sent to the hospital. So even if our people go out there and try to take direct action, they may not be National Guard or Morton County Police or police. They may be private security, but they will still do whatever they need to do to protect that pipeline. That's what we're looking at. From my understanding, it is still a victory. It's still a small win that finally the government said, okay, this is, we'll look at it some more, basically is all it was. Okay, exactly. We'll finally look at some more. It's a shame that it took since April and thousands of people and over 2,000 veterans showing up in the matter of a couple of days for them to be like, oh, wait, we need to take another look at this, when our people have been sacrificing the most for months and months and for decades and for centuries. We have always done what we needed. So it's a victory. You know, they're still working.
And my fear, if it's a fear, my concern is that it's going to go away now in the media, that they're just going to stop talking about it.
Yeah, you know, it took them so long to cover it. Seems like they just showed up now that they heard that all the veterans are going out there. Okay, now we need to go out there and get coverage of it. I was watching the news, and don't get me wrong, I absolutely am so grateful for our veterans and all the work they do and that they showed up and that they're there. But it's like, where was the media before all of this? And the media that... the CNN, the MSNBC, the Fox News, everything, it's all gives you a totally biased look at things, like a one side, and just watching it and having been in camp a couple of times, I'm just like, really? That's what you're going to tell the world, the country? That's what you're going to tell them about this movement? That?
Yeah.
And here it shows for like 1 minute or less on the news, so the media coverage is like, it's just nonsense to me.
Yeah, media coverage is really not coverage.
The Democracy Now! And Unicorn Riot are like the winners in my book. They're covering things, that they're showing things that need to be seen, they're sharing words that need to be said. And of course they're not the only ones. I know like the Young Turks are out there, Indigenous Environmental Network are doing amazing things. There are so many different media outlets, but all of the ones that are not your mainstream are the ones that are doing the right work.
Right.
Yeah.
Because that's where journalism is these days. I always try and ask, what things can people do at this point to support?
Divest from Wells Fargo, divest from U.S. Bank, divest from Bank of America, divest from Chase Bank, divest from Citibank, divest from Key Bank, divest from... God, there's so many.
Yeah.
If you are not with a credit union, divest. Because your bank may not be one of the banks that are contributing to companies like Energy Transfer, but there are other banks that are contributing to other things like the LNG, the liquid natural gas plant, the coal trains, the tar sands. Like, just because all these banks are linked to Dakota Access Pipeline, do some research. If you're connected to a big bank, your bank is most likely connected to some other horrible company that is not doing good things for our planet. So I would say that's the number one thing, because people don't realize how much that can change. You know, 500 people do it, then the bank is like, oh my gosh, and then more, and then more, and then more. You know, there are millions of people in this country. There are millions of people in the world. So maybe our voting system is rigged, but when you count each other as individuals, you can make a lot of things happen. So I would say the number one thing you could do is divest.
Well said, thank you.
Or yes. I scratch that. The number one thing you can do is get educated, do some research, get out of your comfort zone, break out of your privilege, open up, be vulnerable, listen to the others around you, get educated, divest. See, communities, it's crazy because communities are coming together in a different way now. I was in Capitol Hill a couple of weeks ago and they were having a community open to the public, community organization of what to do from here, and it was following a couple of days after the presidential election. You don't have to go very far to find a group or an organization who wants to change the way things are being run in our country right now. So educate yourself, divest from these banks, figure out who you need to be working with to help make things better place. There are so many issues, and this movement is very unique because it is both a spiritual and a activist movement. And so I think that's why people are so drawn to it. But of course, it's not the first thing. Like, Flint, Michigan still doesn't have clean water. So I think that a lot of people are going to continue what they're doing in Standing Rock and continue their support with the tribes. A lot of people are going to make the issue of Flint, Michigan heard again, because I remember hearing about it 2 years ago, and I was definitely not in a place that I am now where I can go be a part of these things. Mm-hmm. But I haven't heard of it really since then until now. So don't forget about things in the past. Don't, you know, how about quit watching mainstream media?
Oh, yay!
And look to the people around you. Mm-hmm. Our native people, our whole entire history is verbal. We survived. Our culture, our traditions have survived through our language, through our storytelling, through our teachings, through our songs, through our dances. We don't have written languages. We are starting to nowadays because it's possible. My grandpa is one of the very last fluent Tlingit speakers in my tribe, and that means a lot to me. But can you imagine Spanish, for example, being completely wiped out? Everybody freaking speaks Spanish. So that's so devastating that, you know, my grandpa is one of the very few, one of the last ones who can fluently speak our language. So we have always told our own history. We don't need people writing books in these history books in high schools teaching us all this crap that never happened or that wasn't true, or that some freaking white guy settler who killed and murdered, you know, my people telling that history. Yeah. No way. And that's exactly what this mainstream media is.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. So,
well, again, it's this whole white blindness, you know, like putting Andrew Jackson on our money.
Yeah, yeah. So stupid.
Yeah.
So if anything, okay, educate yourself. Divest from these banks. Do some research. Get your history and your information and do your research with local people who are around you. You know, go find a rally. You know what happens when you go to a rally? You meet more people on the same page as you. Yep. You meet more people who want to be supportive.
And that's so important. In fact, that's where I am right now. That's why I've been putting all this work into this radio station, because mm-hmm. I want people to be able to connect and learn.
Yeah, and one of the biggest things that I have learned is people really gotta stop being so selfish. Be selfless. For example, my last time in Standing Rock, I experienced all of this, in a way, this oppression being repeated by people who call themselves allies. First of all, that's not my territory, so I too am considered an ally. However, I was raised with these traditions and these protocols, so I know how to respect them, and I do my very best. And if there's an elder around to put me in my place, you be sure that I will listen. However, there are so many people out there who call themselves allies who don't follow the protocol, who don't listen, who are overlooking the direction. And just because you're a nice white person doesn't mean you're not racist. Just because you're a nice white person doesn't mean you're an ally. Just because you have a black friend doesn't mean you're an ally. You know, there's a lot of work, and you have to change everything within your own practices, your own habits that you do to be of service to other people. You have to be selfless, and that's something that my mom has taught me and my sister. That is something that I have learned from my community, from my tribe, from everything that I do. You have to be selfless, you have to be willing, and when you open yourself up like that, a lot of people, and I'll say almost every person in this world, if they can open themselves up in that way, they will gain more connectedness to the earth, to the animals, to a higher power, to every human being they come in contact with. So that's like one of the biggest things. Get out of your ego. And how can you help? Mm-hmm. How can you avoid hurting somebody? What can you do? And if the person next to you is doing that same exact thing, mm-hmm. you don't gotta worry about you.
Yeah.
Because the person next to you got you and you got them. So it's just like that. That's the way it is. That's what you hear in Tlingit language and in a lot of other native languages. Yay away. Just that's the way it is. Finish talking, telling somebody something, just that's the way it is.
Yeah, and that's perfect.
We all know, if you've been following the movement, if you've been following what's going on, we all know that this is just the beginning. This movement is so unique. It sparked a lot of interest. It touched people really close to their hearts and hit home for a lot of people. Like I said, communities are coming together in a way that they haven't before. This ain't no HOA community town hall meeting. It's like communities mm-hmm. are really figuring out how to work with each other. Everything will continue. This is just the beginning. I'm only 21 years old, and so I know that this is what the rest of my life looks like. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really serious. It took a lot of work for me to get where I am now. I mean, I appreciate everybody who's been supportive, who've given me opportunities. Like, for example, just meeting with you today is a really big deal for me. I have done a few teaching presentations to both middle school and high school in Kent, Mill Creek Middle School and Kent Ridge High School. The teachers who are teaching their students about current events, who are using their privilege as teachers to open up these doors to all these young people, because young people are the ones who are going to take over. Mm-hmm. Young people are the ones who are going to keep this change, this way of life alive. So we have to reach out to them. We have to make them feel comfortable. So I've been trying to connect with as many young people as I can by visiting the schools, by going to the culture nights. When I go to rallies and such, when I see the young people, and I say that it sounds kind of weird because I'm a young person too, but I try to connect with them and I try to talk with them and I try to break them out of their shells, because sooner or later they will realize that they're the ones who are going to be taking over.
So can people call on you for workshop?
For me, I have a lot of people I would consider as mentors, I guess. And this is weird that I'm bringing it up now. At my most recent teaching that I did, the teacher asked if I had any business cards to give to the kids. And I was like, no, why on earth would I have that? So what I think, I may be creating like a blog page to where anybody could reach me if anybody wanted to talk with me, ask me questions, because I by no means have all the answers. I'm just sharing everything that I've experienced and everything that I've learned.
Yeah.
But I was going to, and I probably will get working on it now. Okay, it's official. I'm going to make basically like a blog page where I can maybe have a topic and discuss it via like YouTube video or something, and then people could get in contact with me in that way. People who are, I guess, outside of my community circle. Mm-hmm. I think most people usually know how to find me one way or another on Facebook. or a lot of people know who my parents are. My parents are Pamela and Chris Stearns. They're very involved in the Native community and in Seattle community as well. And so a lot of people, in fact, for this interview to happen today, David Bean from the Puyallup tribe reached out to my dad. And then my dad said, "Hey, Stephanie, here's this." And so that's how we got here today. So that's a big deal.
Yes.
So to contact me, if you're part of the community here in Washington and Seattle who are activists or whatever, you'll probably see me around, or you can ask somebody how to get a hold of me, or
yeah.
You could come visit me at the 8th Generation shop at Pike's Place Market over the weekends. I'm always working there, working with Louis Gong and all the amazing, incredible artists on our team. So
yeah, and they can always contact Radio Tacoma, and then we can connect
Radio
there too.
Tacoma as well, because you got my information. That is a beautiful way.
It's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Even though the easement for the Dakota Access Pipeline has been stopped, the struggle continues. We need to keep up the resistance until all the other pipelines, oil trains, and liquid natural gas terminals are no longer a part of our economy. We will continue to keep people educated about tribal lands, cultural history, and the dangers to our environment. We need to understand how all of this is connected to the economy, television, and our fingernails. Fingernails? Yes, fingernails. I will be tying all these things together in a separate podcast called Imaginal Cells and Saving the Earth. That podcast is available at radiotacoma.org. Thank you for listening. I'm Louisa Beale with Radio Tacoma.